Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, 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 my wonderful, wonderful worldwide radio and television audience. Thanks to Gary Null and PRN.FM, this show airs first as radio on PRN, and then the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour airs as a TV weekly show, usually the day after on Thursdays, on my YouTube channel, the Dr. Peter Breggin YouTube channel. This has been an interesting several weeks for me in terms of the broadcasting I've been doing. I've done solo shows on a number of interesting subjects. One of them is guilt, shame, anxiety, but starting with epidemic anxiety, in which I talk about what's going on in the world that scares us, what goes on in our lives that scares, what is anxiety, how do we overcome it? And then I've done another show on epidemic shame, because I think they're both kind of epidemic in the world today, talking about shame on the political level, but shame also on the personal level and how it really inhibits our creativity. Very pleased with both those shows. The next show will be on guilt. I don't think we can call guilt an epidemic, however. I'd say, if anything, it's a withering emotion to some extent in Western culture, where it has always been so famous up till now. And I'm continuing to do individual shows on occasion, including one on the greatest menace we're facing in psychiatry today. So actually, that was a blog. Well, anyway, I'm doing a lot of good stuff. I'm blogging on Madden America and just keeping very, very busy and enjoying this tremendous ability to communicate with you. My website's Breggin.com. And I don't often mention my books. I think I should do it more often. My three most recent books that will give you tons of information about my critical view of psychiatry and my positive view of life: guilt, shame, and anxiety, how to understanding and overcoming our negative emotions. I love that book. I spent decades getting ready to write that book, and it's a really good discussion of how we can free ourselves to be rational, loving beings. Medication Madness, which really tells the story for the public, but with a lot of science on what is the problem with psychiatric medications. And then the only medical book still on psychiatric drug withdrawal. It's called Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and it's a manual, a guidebook, I call it, for prescribers, for therapists, patients, and their families. It's a book to get the family together, get the treating people together in order to help people come off psychiatric drugs. Now, my guest today is as wonderful as my audience, maybe just spectacular. And she is Joanna Moncrief. Joanna, hi. Well, let me wave to you across the pond.
Hi, Peter.
it's so wonderful to be doing this as not just a radio show, but a TV show. I just love it. I love seeing you. I haven't seen you in a while. And I've had Joanna on my radio shows before. She has two books out that are really important: the Myth of the Chemical Cure and The Bitterest Pills. And The Myth of the Chemical Cure deals with very broad issues in psychiatry. It takes a look at the drugs from a somewhat similar viewpoint that I do, that they're not medication specific at all for illnesses. They are basically neurotoxic. I don't recall whether she uses that term. I've been using it more and more. And The Bitterest Pills, a deep critique of of the psychiatric drugs, and particularly the antipsychotic drugs. And I thought we'd start off today and talk a little bit about the coronavirus in the Great Britain and United States. It's not often, I think, that we get to talk to a sane person without who's very scientific and who isn't pushing a political agenda, and find out what is it looking like in Great Britain right now in terms of the coronavirus. I think we're in a somewhat similar stage. I can't exactly explain that, but here in America, for those of you who aren't here, our president has been taking this very strong leadership role in closing down our borders to countries that have a lot of coronavirus in it. He did it very early, got a lot of criticism in regard to China, but I think it's turned out to be very valuable. And basically throughout the states, the schools are closing, businesses are closing. We're being urged basically to here in America to stay indoors as much as possible, do as much work as we can by distance methods, to wash our hands, so whether we're in the house or not a lot, and to do social distancing, particularly when we're out in public. The economy here has been being shut down segment by segment, basically, and now the president is coming out with Congress and with both parties recommending huge stimulus packages to compensate our economy for the crashing. I think we're down 30% now, stock market, which is, of course, worldwide. What is happening, Joanna, right now in Great Britain and Europe in terms of the coronavirus?
Yes. Hi, Peter. Well, it's an extraordinary situation, isn't it? I mean, really extraordinary. Much of Europe has been rather ahead of the UK and the United States. We have just here in the UK today been told that schools are shutting on Friday until further notice.
And today is, by the way, is March 18th, 2020, if I didn't mention.
Yes.
So go ahead.
Yeah. So they're shutting down 2 weeks ahead of when they would normally have shut for the Easter holidays, but who knows when they'll open again. That's not been said. Lots of universities have cancelled their summer terms altogether and are putting all their teaching online. University College London, where I work, is shutting all its buildings completely as from Friday. Most of them are shut now already. Completely shut down. Everyone doing research at UCL has been told they've got to stop unless they're doing research on coronavirus. All the labs have been shut unless they're being used for research on coronavirus. Drug trials, you know, all medical research is just being put on hold unless it is
Wow.
coronavirus related. So there are huge implications to what's happening at the moment. You know, every area of life is just shutting down, just coming to a halt. And you mentioned there was that Trump's announced a big stimulus package. The government in London has also announced that there'll be, you know, billions of pounds available to support businesses. They're expected to announce more money to support individual workers in very soon, in the next few days, if they haven't done so already. So I think there'll be more money being put on the table just to keep everyone going. We're in a similar position. Older people have been told to stay in, and then they may need to stay in the house for another 12 weeks. The pubs and theatres and things haven't been officially closed, but people have been told to stay away. So most of them are just closing voluntarily anyway. So as my son said earlier, How can we be Britain without pubs?
Well, how can we be America without, you know, baseball, yeah, basketball, yeah, football, yeah. Broadway is closed.
Yes, all sports shut down here as well. It's absolutely extraordinary, isn't it? Extraordinary situation. I've never lived through anything like it. And I just hope to goodness that, you know, it starts to... it starts to go away soon and things can get back to normal, because so many businesses are not going to survive and people will lose their livelihoods. And it's terrible.
Even our conservatives, who are more conservative than Donald Trump, are taking the view that this is not an ordinary business cycle. This is a depression, certainly a recession caused by the government, and therefore the government has to take responsibility for pumping money in a way that the conservative economists would not necessarily say. So this is going to be a giant fiscal experiment as well. Mm. It's exciting times throughout the world today.
It's interesting how different countries will deal with it differently. So in France, people have been told that they must stay in their houses, and they're being fined if they're found on the streets without a good reason. And the police are patrolling the streets to enforce these new laws. So whether we here in the UK and you in the US will end up in that situation, I don't know.
Yeah, well, there's been talk of various things like that. The mayor of New York City has been saying he may just set up a quarantine and enforce it legally. Mm-hmm. There's discussions between the mayor and the governor of New York who has the power to do what. Right. So it's all very complicated. I haven't heard about our research facilities shutting down at NIH except for coronavirus. No one is talking about anything like that so far. Yeah. Our president goes on the air now every day, flanked by the heads of the major federal agencies involved in this entire process. Is something like that going on in Great Britain?
Yes. So the Prime Minister, again, is giving a press conference every day in collaboration with his medical advisors. One of the issues is that the medical advice, the medical research is changing all the time. A lot of the medical advice is based on modeling, which is basically making assumptions about what will happen in the future. And of course, no one really knows. So it's all uncertain, and one day can be different from the next. Last week, the UK was taking a relatively liberal line and, taking the view that actually we needed to expose the population to develop immunity. This week, that's all gone out of the window, and the idea is to try and suppress it and minimize cases as far as possible.
Yeah, I think the problem people are talking about is not overwhelming the health system.
Yeah.
Even if we end up with the same number of cases, let's do it over a longer period of time so we can save lives when we can.
Yeah, which of course makes sense. I mean, the other strange thing is that, I still work as a psychiatrist. I still see patients, outpatients, but I have some patients who are, or some of my patients go into the hospital from time to time. And that, of course, is all going on, more or less as normal. We're doing some consultations over the telephone, but we're still seeing people when, if we feel that's the best thing to do. Of course, there are still patients in the hospital, which is really difficult if one of them gets coronavirus. There are some mental health units around London where people have got coronavirus and are having to be isolated inside the mental health unit, which of course is, it must be really difficult for everyone involved, for all the patients, both those with the virus and those without, and all the staff. All sorts of complications it's causing that we hadn't anticipated.
Yeah, it's interesting what's happened with my practice. I have some Chinese students in my practice. There are many Chinese students at Cornell, mm-hmm. and I'm not affiliated with Cornell, but I get referrals and I get to see patients. And they quarantined themselves when they came back from spring break, and mm-hmm. and I began to see them on the phone, basically using FaceTime. Mm-hmm. And I'm very fond of these people. And it's continued from there. I think probably because of my concerns that this is such an international city, a little Ithaca, where the university is is the same size as the city itself, and then there's Ithaca College. So I'm seeing my patients entirely now by telecommunication, and it's going quite well. I've often done it on and off over the years anyway, when people travel and so on, and it's working out well. I don't know what's happening in the rest of Ithaca yet. Because of my age, you know, I'm 83, and my wife is, about 14 years younger than me, which makes her elderly. and my mother-in-law, Jean, who's like my mom, is 93. So we have a house of older people, and we have gone into almost a quarantine for ourselves. We don't go out at all right now. We have stopped going out. Mm-hmm. We're not talking in this country about 15 weeks. I mean, the measure that the government's using right now is 15 days as a start. Yeah. And we have two people whom we know well and trust who come in and out of the house in a very careful manner. And we're not going out. And I think that's very wise at our age.
It's going to be very tough for some people, isn't it? I mean, I've got friends who live on their own. Some of whom are elderly or have got health conditions and, you know, worried about going out. And that's going to be very difficult for people. So we've all been on the phone to each other saying, you know, we must keep in touch and phone and Skype and and thank goodness we have these technologies available to us now, because it would have been very miserable a few decades ago, wouldn't it, when it was more difficult to keep in touch with each other. Yeah.
Yeah, it would have been quite strange. Excuse me, I just did a radio show last night talking to 6 million people on George Norrie's Coast to Coast about anxiety from the coronavirus and what can we do about it and how can we handle it. Would you say you're seeing a certain amount of panic in Great Britain or Europe at this time? We're seeing some oddities here, like the shelves are being cleared. Of all kinds of things. The big joke is toilet paper went first. People have just gone out and bought up all the toilet paper there is. You literally can't buy hand sanitizer. We still have plenty of soap, I guess. Today, when our assistant Missy went shopping, there were no hamburger rolls, and other things were in short order.
So I've been to the local supermarket a number of times over the last few days. It's extraordinary. The shelves are completely empty.
Oh my gosh.
Blimey, it must be like, you know, what used to be in Eastern Europe or something. There's just nothing there. When I went at the weekend, there were some fresh vegetables, but all the tins and all the dried food was gone completely. But now there aren't even any fresh vegetables, fruit and vegetables left.
It's much worse in Great Britain. We've only had 2 or 3 days of this, and there's no sense, I don't think, that we're going to clear our shelves off completely. It's just getting a little harder to get things.
Yeah.
But tell me, how long has that been now in Great Britain?
Again, just a few days, really. And I think it's partly because the government are talking about, you know, this may be being a 12 weeks until, you know, we're over the peak and things might be safe. So I suppose people are thinking long term. But the people I meet, including all the elderly people I meet, seem very sanguine about it and very relaxed. I haven't met anyone who seems to be panicking. They don't run out of toilet roll.
I think we're seeing a little bit more anxiety here in this country. On the part of people, but we're doing well. Thank God that we've had the strongest economy in the history of our country right now, and hopefully that will just be able to bounce back, and that the world will just bounce back as this thing comes under control.
That's the worry for me, is, you know, we've had so many years of austerity and government cutbacks, and you know, our public services are already pared down to the bone. You know, that there's been so little funding for schools and the education. The social care system is on its knees. And, you know, now we're going to have to be paying back all the money we've borrowed to bail out everyone for this problem. So we're going to face more and more years of cuts. So it's very, very depressing from that point of view for anyone that works in public services or uses public services, which of course is almost everyone. So, yeah, so that's...
Well, one of my hopes, I didn't expect to talk politically, but one of my hopes is this is going to be a lot more cooperation between Great Britain and the United States now that you have Brexit. I think that that could just turn out to be a wonderful thing for both our countries. And we've been very prosperous, and I'm hoping that our government's going to find a way to really work closely with Great Britain and help you really become prosperous again, you know, through trade with us and cooperation with us. It's my big hope.
Well,
does anybody in Great Britain think that way, that it's an opportunity to get closer to the U.S.?
Yes, I'm sure there are people who look on that, you know, welcome that. I think there are also people who are worried about that and worried that that means, you know, that we'll be driving down standards of, you know, hygiene and animal welfare in agricultural production and things like that. So there are some concerns about it. There are concerns that the health service will be brought up by, you know, US health providers.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That must
be terrifying.
Discussed at some point. So there are worries about it, but of course there are good sides to it too.
I've never heard a whisper of that in the US that could happen. I mean, of course, it can't happen without your government permission, I would think. But I mean, we do guard our health services, but who knows? Who knows? Never occurred to me. Imperial America taking over Great Britain is not one of the things I foresee. We've become such an America First country in that regard. I'm not sure there'd be that much interest in it. But that is so interesting to get to different perspectives. I want to say another word or two just for the folks about you, about Joanna Moncrief. In addition to her good books and her scientific articles, gosh, we've known each other for decades. Joanna is just a most remarkable person. I don't think we have anybody like you in the United States, and that Joanna is a part of the conventional health system, the institutional health system in Great Britain. She has positions that in this country would be, I guess, considered professorial positions in academia. We're going to talk about some research that she has been able to create and construct, remarkable research within the institutes of Great Britain. And furthermore, she, in her books, she actually looks favorably on my work and discusses it openly and unapologetically, which is most remarkable. I mean, you'd be lynched in an American residency program for carrying one of my books around, I think.
Yep.
So there's a greater... I think part of it's a greater openness in Great Britain, and I think that there, as Joanne has told me, British psychiatrists still, many of them at least, still think of themselves as doing psychotherapy, and they do get psychotherapy training. I've just written a blog that's getting quite a bit of attention. I think it's called The Most Dangerous Thing you Can Do, and it's about going to a psychiatrist in the United States, because all you're going to get is a diagnosis and a drug. That's what they do. And in other words, you'll be put on a neurotoxin and very likely told that you have to be on it for the rest of your life. I think it's a little better, would you say, in Great Britain?
I think it's a bit better. I mean, but I still recognize what you're describing, the sort of person who, you know, comes in is distressed, is going through a bad patch in their life, is really finding it difficult to cope, reaching out for different solutions, ends up being put on one drug. Of course, that doesn't help because most of them don't in that situation, and it gives them some side effects, so they end up being put on another drug. And often they end up with me 2, 3, 4 years down the line, by which time they've become quite chronic, they've lost all their self-confidence. They've got lots of side effects from the drugs. They don't any longer you know, think they can really sort things out in their lives. And, you know, so much damage has been done. So I think it does happen here. But I do think that it probably happens slightly less. I mean, the health service here is pretty overwhelmed, which in one way is a bad thing, because then the easiest thing to do is put someone on an antidepressant. You need to get them out of the, you know, get them out of your office as quickly as possible. On the other hand, it means that no one is looking to create patients in this country. No one is trying to medicalize things. They're really just trying to sort of troubleshoot most of the time. So, and I think we've always had, you know, because of the National Health Service, which I know you know, we may have slightly different views about, but the National Health Service, you know, because it's government money, it's taxpayers' money, it's always been run with this view to efficiency. So this view that really you need to be able to justify any intervention that you prescribe, any drug that you prescribe, it has to be based on good evidence, and you should not be using expensive drugs or any more drugs than you need to. So I think that is a philosophy that, you know, that the National Health Service has helped to foster to some extent. It can't always combat the propaganda that's coming from the pharmaceutical industry or the other sort of interests that are at work. But I think there is that attitude here. I wanted to say I'm now I'm now an official professor. I probably wasn't the last time I came on your show. So I have been officially made a professor. And as we've spoken of before, I got this money to do this study on trying to help people come off antipsychotics, and that was money that came from the government research and development funding stream. Mm-hmm. So they recognized that this was something that we, you know, should be looking into, that and that we should be trying to minimize people's exposure to drugs. I think there's probably more of that sort of thinking here in the UK and across Europe really than there is in the US. Having said that, there's still lots and lots of prescribing. Most psychiatrists and certainly prominent psychiatrists think that antidepressants are, you know, the bee's knees, and that in fact we're not prescribing enough of them, even though we've got well over 10% of the population are taking them already. They still think we should be prescribing more of them. And when people complain about the difficulties they have trying to get off antidepressants, there are many leading psychiatrists who've poo-pooed them and, you know, tried to suggest that they're making it up. This is just, you know, part of their psychological problems. It's not really that these drugs
could still goes on
causing withdrawal problems. Mm. I know, exactly. We've been here before, haven't we? When I started to read about, read in detail about the experiences people were having coming off antidepressants, I looked back at some early papers on benzodiazepine withdrawal. And it's all there, back in the right back in the 1980s.
Yeah.
These awful withdrawal syndromes were being described, where people would, in which people would get really quite bizarre symptoms, you know, tinnitus, dizziness, which sometimes just continued, persisted, you know, didn't go away.
Yeah.
So we've known about all these problems before, and yet, you know, and yet we forget, and we want to pretend that what we prescribe is, you know, all terribly benign and doesn't damage people. I think it's something about being a doctor that people do find it difficult to acknowledge that the medical things they prescribe might be harmful. You know, we look at all medical interventions through rose-tinted glasses and are rather reluctant to, you know, acknowledge the negative effects, the damage that they can cause.
Well, the whole identity that we have is based on our superiority to every other citizen because we have medical degrees. Mm. I think for many decades it was the nearest thing to an aristocracy, being a physician. I think people have kind of begun to see through that, and it isn't holding up as strongly. But physicians, we come from a position which I think is fundamentally wrong. in regard to helping people with emotional, psychological problems across the spectrum, including people who are psychotic or get labeled schizophrenic or manic or bipolar or whatever, that what we are trained in is not what's appropriate. And yet we get so much power and authority from it. And now we have the drug companies behind us. And in the United States, we have direct-to-consumer advertising, which means that the media is 100% behind it. We can't really go on television anymore and say anything critical of the drug companies or drugs or at all anymore in the U.S. I was on so much more television decades ago. But as soon as that change took place, it became like the cigarette companies when they used to advertise so much on TV and you couldn't, for decades, get any criticism of cigarettes on TV or the big radio shows. So I think the fundamental problem is insolvable because we come at it from the background that all of who we are is this medical, biologic, a reductionist scientific model, and that's just not where human suffering comes from.
I think I agree with you. I also think there's something rather, when I think back on my medical training, I think there's something heroic about our image of the doctor, isn't there? And
that's, yes.
That's sort of bred into us during the training as well, that you are the hero and you're going to cure people and save people's lives. And so we have real difficulty appreciating both that we can't solve everything and that sometimes the things we do are actually worse than the problem in the first place. I was just talking today with someone about the opioid crisis in the United States. I mean, we've known the problems of opiates for decades, for centuries. We've known the problems of opiates. And yet, once again, the pharmaceutical industry was able to come along and persuade doctors to mass prescribe these drugs. I mean, that's just extraordinary. Doctors should have been able and should still be able to say no, to resist that sort of pressure. And yet, I feel there's something about our identity that makes us unable to do that very well, which is a real problem, and particularly a problem, as you say, when you're dealing with people with emotional and behavioral difficulties, when actually, you know, trying to understand them in terms of biology is fundamentally the wrong starting point as well.
I think it though that I have a somewhat different view of the opioid crisis in the US, because I think that while what you're saying is true about doctors in general, the opioid crisis, I think, is much more the product of a combination of despair among our young people in general, and that the opioid overdoses that are occurring are in the context of young people abusing drugs in general, and that China, interestingly enough, is a big player in this because they've flooded the country with fentanyl manufactured in China, coming in, I think, mostly through Mexico, and a lot of the deaths are on fentanyl, which is not even prescribed very much in the U.S. It's their origins are for cancer treatment, end stage, people in severe pain. It can be hundreds of times stronger than routine opiates. And then we also have the problem of the individual criminal physicians and pharmacies that are doing a lot of the prescribing. So I think we are now in a, excuse me, I'm not getting sick, folks, I'm recovering. So don't worry for me when I cough. Believe it or not, I got the flu virus type A documented a little more than a week ago. So I'm actually doing great in recovery. Doing wonderfully. Actually handled it very well for my age. I'm in good health. But we're in an upside down situation now where doctors in the US aren't prescribing enough opiates for pain control. And instead they're going to the pharmaceutical favorites, Lyrica and even the antidepressants, which are just terrible drugs The opiates are much better if you have genuine pain, physical pain. So I think it's a bit more complicated than just our doctors repeating an old pattern. But I think there's some truth to that, too. But it's not the source of most of what's happening with these young kids who are dying. They're not mostly getting their opiates from docs. They weren't mostly started on opiates for pain. They're mostly despairing young people who've been on psych drugs and have been on street drugs, and then they start on the opiates as additional drugs, and then it's often fentanyl coming in from criminal sources in China. Have you heard that commentary before?
So there was a documentary on British television that suggested, it was about a town in California, and it suggested that the vast majority of people who were using opiates, which they were often getting illicitly, had started them had been prescribed them initially. So that was what made me think.
I don't think that's the overall picture in the U.S., unfortunately. Well, fortunately, in a way. And I think that we're tending to underprescribe now. I know people now who have been in our hospitals and post-surgically, they tried to treat them in the hospitals without opiesand that was potential disaster when you have post-surgical pain. So I think it's gotten a bit more complicated here. It's an international drug pushing problem in the U.S. that we're struggling with. But God, all of these things are so complicated. We've got about 15 more minutes to complicate everything if we want.
On that issue then, it reminded me, because I was also thinking about this in relation to something else, of what I think, why I think we ended up with our misunderstanding of psychiatric drugs. And I think it was partly because of the recreational drug epidemic in the 1960s, which was set off by the diversion of prescription amphetamines and barbiturates. And I think it was partly because widespread recreational drug use cast a sort of negative light on what doctors were doing, and particularly psychiatrists, and the prescription of medication for, you know, anxiety, depression, etc. I think that was partly what stimulated this misperception that drugs are, you know, these sophisticated things
yes.
that target an underlying illness, because that was a way for the psychiatrist to say, no, we're not drug pushers. We are doing proper medical practice. When we give amphetamines, we're giving it to correct ADHD. And when we give Valium, we're giving it to correct the basis of the disease of anxiety. I think the use of drugs recreationally and the prescription of psychiatric drugs are enmeshed, aren't they? And it's a problem for psychiatrists that some of their drugs are drugs that actually get diverted, and it's clear that that these drugs cause an altered mindset that may well explain what they're supposedly doing in when they're given to people with psychiatric problems, mental health problems.
Yes, you've been looking in some depth at this latest bizarre situation with the use of that heavy sedative drug.
Ketamine.
Ketamine.
Yeah.
There's a great movie, Armageddon, I think it is the title of it, where America has to send up some people to blow up an asteroid that's coming in to destroy the country. It's with Bruce Willis. He does a great job. It's actually, I love the movie, actually. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that our astronauts are just not equipped to go and drill on this asteroid. And this is a movie from, I don't know, 20 years ago or more. And so they go to Bruce Willis's mining crew. And one of the men in his crew is this giant guy who's really just huge, and he's a sort of a wild guy. There's many of these miners are who are digging around the world under Bruce Willis, at least. And one of the things that they find, you know, this man can't go into space. He's taking a horse pill, a horse sedative, ketamine. And Bruce says, well, he's a big guy. You know, he's a big guy. And it's so funny, my colleagues now are pushing ketamine for depression. Tell us that crazy story.
Yeah, so I mean, this is fascinating, and again, starts in your crazy country. So some people started opening clinics and giving people injections of IV ketamine. Sometimes this was done in a sort of psychotherapeutic way, with the idea that, you know, you'd have this sort of mind-altered experience. You'd do it in conjunction with a therapist. I think ecstasy and LSD are also being used in this way, and that maybe that would, you know, enable people to deal with, you know, past trauma or get over some anxiety. So that was the way it started. And then ketamine clinics start up, where people go back and they keep getting regular sort of fixes. So that became popular. Then Janssen developed an inhaled, a nasal inhalation version of ketamine, which is called esketamine, but it's just as strong as ketamine, in fact. And people, and the process with that is that you go in and you inhale your esketamine 3 times a week, and then you're observed afterwards to make sure that you're not physically in danger in any way, and then you're let out of the clinic and then you come back again. So esketamine was recently licensed by the FDA for this three weekly mode of administration, and has just been considered by the European Medicines Agency and the UK Medicines Agency. And basically, there were three trials. I'm trying to remind myself now of how many exactly. So normally the FDA has to have two positive trials, but of the three trials of acute treatment for treatment-resistant depression, it's being marketed for, of those three trials, only one was positive. The other two weren't positive at all. So then they roped in a relapse prevention study, and they found some positive findings in that. So then they said, okay, we've got our two studies, although they don't usually use a relapse prevention study. So they licensed it on the basis of this one positive acute treatment study and this relapse prevention study. What they failed to say, they skated over the fact that two of the studies were negative. They also failed to highlight that there was a huge placebo response across all the studies. Obviously, if you're getting people in, you know, to do the slightly odd procedure and then giving people lots of attention and care afterwards, there's going to be a placebo effect. And most worrying of all, what they skated over was that actually there were a lot of potential worrying effects associated with the esketamine. So there were several deaths in the esketamine group, none in the placebo group.
That's very I didn't know this. Very unusual, Joanna.
Yeah, yes, exactly. In a drug trial, it's almost unheard of, because you select very healthy people, don't you?
Yes.
So there was a heart attack, there was a road traffic accident, and a number of other incidents like that. And there were three suicides, all in the esketamine group, all after, shortly after cessation of the esketamine. So quite probably associated with the down that you get up following the high that you get with a recreational drug like esketamine. So I think it's really worrying. And a group of us in the UK wrote to the drug regulation organization in the UK to express our concerns. They took no notice. But NICE, that's the organization that decides whether medication will be funded by the health service, they have decided that they're not going to fund it for now, that it doesn't look as if it's value for money. So that's some sort of positive outcome. And I think the other thing it just highlights to me is the way that psychiatrists and researchers and drug companies are able to do this sort of doublespeak. So we know that ketamine is something that makes people high, you know, gives people, puts people into an altered state that some people enjoy, some people don't enjoy it, but some people enjoy it, clearly. It's a, you know, recreation mm-hmm. drug. But it's extraordinary how these researchers are able to talk about that high as an antidepressant effect. You know, that they, which you would get with any, you know, if you give someone heroin or cocaine and you measure their, you know, you do a depression score a couple of hours later, of course you're going to show an antidepressant effect if that's how you want to talk about it.
That is the same thing that the criminal electroshock doctors do. I've read so many charts in regard to electroshock treatment when I've been in product liability suits. I'm still involved in big product liability suits here in the U.S., malpractice suits. The patient, after one or two treatments, tends to get euphoric from brain injury. It's brain damage euphoria. And the doctors write in the always write a positive remark in the chart, such as mood elevated.
Yes.
Never do they write artificial high, euphoria, brain damage, we better stop the treatment. It's sick.
Sometimes they talk about tipping people into mania, don't they? They call it mania.
Yes.
Which is another way of sort of blaming the disease, blaming the condition, and you know, enabling yourself to ignore the harmful effects of treatment. The other extraordinary thing about that, about ECT and that euphoric effect, which I've seen several times in my practice as a doctor, it definitely occurs. I don't think it occurs with everyone, but it definitely does occur.
It tends to turn into apathy eventually. All brain damage, my experience, usually leads to apathy, not a permanent high.
Yes, absolutely. But as you say, immediately what you get is this state of euphoria, but it's a distinctive state of euphoria where people are sort of silly and disinhibited in ways that it isn't quite the same as just, you know, if you gave someone a big shot of cocaine or something. It's not just pure euphoria or high.
No, there's more injury in it. The memory is going.
Exactly. So it definitely occurs, but it's very difficult to find reference to it in the literature, isn't it, in the published literature?
Right. I found it enough so that I've got it in you know, my first book in 1979 on electroshock and in my papers. But you got to dig.
Absolutely. Yes. And very, very little recent acknowledgement. You have to go back a long way, don't you, when people were a bit more honest when they brought these things in.
Well, you know, before I wrote my shock book in 1979, they were very honest about how people thought they were dying on shock treatment. People had rebirth experiences and how people did it because they hated themselves. I mean, it was all kinds of stuff. But once I started quoting them, they really cleaned up their published act, unfortunately. Joanna, can you say a little more? First, you're educating me marvelously and the audience about ketamine. And say some more about what is ketamine nearest to with drugs we're more familiar with?
So it's a strange drug. So it's used as an anesthetic and it's a muscle relaxant. But it also seems to have a slightly stimulant properties and a slightly hallucinogenic quality to it. So people get this state, it's referred to in the literature as dissociation. So people get sort of, you know, have this sort of out of body experience.
Yeah, which is considered in the DSM, of course, mental disorder.
Yes.
It's actually very, very common, and a lot of people get it from stress or.
Yes.
Normally. So it causes a dissociative process.
Yes.
Where you're separate from yourself, your body, the world around you.
And people get sort of tunnel vision and really get, I mean, a bit like the sort of amphetamine folk, you know, the narrowing of focus with amphetamines. People get into, it's called a K-hole, get this sort of tunnel vision where they're just focusing on, not really oblivious to their surroundings and focusing on a bit of the floor or something like that.
Mm-hmm. That's so very helpful.
It's a strange drug. It's
addictive. I mean, we know it's addictive, right?
Yes. Again, it's a bit like stimulants, I think. Not so much like the opiates or benzodiazepines. So the come down is the main feature is this depression.
Mm-hmm. Crashing,
of course, yeah.
It's a mixed sedative stimulant. It's an unusual drug. Very interesting. Before we finish up, I want to get to one other thing you mentioned to me when we were doing our pre-interview, and I continue to learn from you, and that is that there's a new article out in a journal called Psychiatry JAMA. The Journal of the American Medical Association has a psychiatry journal, I think a surgical journal, and this is in February of this year, and it's a study of brain scans on patients taking Zyprexa, which is olanzapine, and Joanna sent it to me, Joanna Moncrief, I should mention your last name some more, and I first wrote about this in 1983 with my first book, Psychiatric Drugs. I talked about brain damage from the antipsychotic drugs. I mean, there was so much in the literature at that point, I was able to demonstrate it beyond a doubt. It's still in doubt, folks. But this is a breakthrough to have this article come out. It may help you in Great Britain in your efforts.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really important article, isn't it? And the reason it's so important is the people in it are not people with schizophrenia. They're people who've had a psychotic depression. They've been put on olanzapine, and then some of them get transferred to placebo. And the people who stay on olanzapine get a significant cortical shrinkage of their brain's cortex, the bit that we use to do our sort of higher human thinking and feeling. And that shrinks significantly more in the people on olanzapine compared to the people who transfer onto placebo. Now, the reason it's important that it's not in people with schizophrenia is previously when you and other people demonstrated that people with schizophrenia had smaller brains, people who'd been on antipsychotics for a long time had smaller brains, it was always said, oh, it's due to the schizophrenia. It shows that schizophrenia is a brain disease. It's nothing to do with the drug treatment. And, you know, you were one of the only people saying consistently, no, it's the drug treatment, it's the drug treatment, it's the drug treatment, weren't you, for decades and decades?
Yes, thank you for that.
And really, it was only with the animal study, the study with macaque monkeys, which put it absolutely beyond doubt and showed that these antipsychotics, you know, shrink the brains of monkeys, that I think, you know, anyone else really started to take it on board. And I think I would say that now most psychiatrists in the UK would accept that position. They probably don't talk about it that much, but, you know, I think they would now accept that this has been demonstrated, that this is a concern.
Do you think, by the way, Joanna is a founder of the Critical Psychiatry Network in Great Britain, of which I'm a member and participate somewhat. It's one of these email things where everybody talks together, and they have conferences canceled because of the coronavirus. And Joanna's group, and Joanna has tried to get the British authorities at the annual conferences to simply have a workshop on brain damage. Hasn't been able from psychiatric drugs, in particular antipsychotics, and has not been able to accomplish it. And in the U.S., no one's even trying. So, Do you think you'll be able to do that?
Well, the story is that I did finally do that. So
Tell me.
It was a symposium about the long-term effects of antipsychotics. So I applied twice to do twice to do a symposium on this subject at the Royal College of Psychiatrists annual conference and was turned down. Then I asked Professor Robin Murray, who's the, you know, best known psychiatrist in the country, who was going to participate in the symposium. I asked him if he would apply instead of me. He applied, and immediately it was accepted.
so, So have you had it now? Has it been done?
Yes, we did this a couple of years ago now.
And were there any follow-up ones?
And Robin Murray, the reason I'd invited him is he did some research which also shows that antipsychotics, you know, shrink brains. So he is, you know, now convinced that this is absolutely true and a really important fact.
I think the verdict now has to be, and you'll see a good review of it in my book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, that all classes of psychiatric drugs, probably all classes of psychoactive substances, mm-hmm. will shrink brain tissue. They're neurotoxins, they poison nerve functions, and one of the first things to go are, unfortunately, our very highest centers. Golly, we're going to be drawing to the close soon. Joanna Moncrief, I just love seeing you as we're talking. So, folks, if you're hearing this on the radio, try watching it, too. I think you'll find it's just amazing to see what it's like to see two folks who think and like each other and talk about these issues, how we look when we're talking about it. I know that for me, the enjoyment of doing the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour just escalated, as did also the audience, when I went to doing through PRN, you know, doing it recorded, so we can then, the following day after the radio show, put it up on YouTube, on my channel. So this is just a wonderful opportunity for me. And it's just really ups the enjoyment of the overall show. Makes me want to just keep on doing it. And I want to have you on really more often now. And God bless you. Thank you for being alive. Thank you for being there, Joanna Moncrief.
Thank you, Peter. It's been a great pleasure, as always. I've really enjoyed it. And keep well and safe. We need these programs, don't we, at this time?
Yes. Keep well and safe. And I am well and safe, folks. I have, at my age, weathered the flu.